Greetings, Monk Rowe here, director of the Phileas Jazz Archive at Hamilton College, and your podcast host. This season 5 episode, number 35, focuses on jazz vocalists. Let's start with a multiple choice question. Go ahead and respond out loud if you'd like. The question is, do you think a vocalist who does not play an instrument is a musician? Choose A, of course they are. B, well, no, not really. And C, why is this even a question? Here's a bit of music while you decide. Time's up. I'm guessing that the majority of the A responses, of course they are, came from vocalists, and B responses, not really, came from instrumentalists, especially those who've worked with those who chose A. And hopefully we'll illuminate why C, like, why is this a question, was even included. Here's a personal and debatable observation. If we consider the role of singers in the popular music forms of rock, blues, jazz, funk, folk, hip-hop, and the all-encompassing roots music, vocalists, comparatively, have played the most limited role in the jazz idiom. Of course, we acknowledge the iconic voices of Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Joe Williams, and numerous other singers. But since its gelling as a musical style in the early 20th century, jazz has been predominantly an instrumental music with melodies played by typically wind instruments. But the jazz landscape in 2025 is vastly different than the scene in 1935, where the big bands found it necessary to carry a so-called chirper or boy singer who spent the majority of a performance sitting stage left, waiting to be introduced for a song or two. Major concert venues, festivals, and clubs now seek out jazz singers as headliners. Catherine Russell, Gregory Porter, Kurt Elling, and Samara Joy have definitely made it in the business. We're going to divide this podcast into two parts. We'll first hear from the jazz vocalists who have enjoyed success in the field, followed by a bit of advice for those singers who hope to. If you're an inspiring singer, you might want to take notes. Have I mentioned that I'm an avid fan of saxophonist Cannonball Adderley, and that my favorite Cannonball recording is his 1961 session with vocalist Nancy Wilson? Early on in our oral history project, I was fortunate to speak with Nancy Wilson. Here she is, from our November 1995 conversation.
And I have to say about jazz critics, they really gave me a fits for a while. I mean, they felt that the Cannonball Adderley album, it was a compromise for Cannon because I was a pop artist.
Kidding.
Oh, yes. You don't know the stuff they did to us.
Oof.
But my point that I've always tried to stress is I came into this business and with a gift. The voice is a given. It was a gift from God. I didn't put any labels on it. I also decided to leave my home to do this, to be commercial. I mean, the object of the game for me was, why would anybody in their right mind want to give up their security, their home, all the things that mean happiness to me, to go out to only want to fulfill somebody else's idea of who and what I am. I figured that I was going to do this on a major scale, or I didn't want to do it because I could go home, go to Carnegie Tech as opposed to Central State, and be a doctor or be something in medicine, and I'd have been fine. But the voice was always out front.
Yeah.
But I have never apologized for being a commercial artist. That is why I do what I do, is to sell. I want to be heard. I want to be I want to reach as many people as I can. I believe in that mass thing. You know, I want everybody to know who I am.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. So when I listened to the things that Leonard Feather used to get on me, it would be, I was not as jazz. I mean, I wasn't a true jazz artist. Well, I've never professed to be. What does that mean, of being a true
jazz
artist?
Good question. What is a true jazz vocalist mean?
Right.
Vocalist Janice Segel, who sang jazz for 50 years with the Manhattan Transfer and now pursues a solo career, addresses this question.
Okay, what makes a jazz singer a jazz singer?
Well, I think there's a few characteristics. I mean, the jury is out as to whether improvisation is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a phrasing thing, I think, and a sophistication that is one of the characteristics, I think, of a jazz singer. And there's a truth to it, you know. It's a funny subject. I think a jazz singer would be one that is a musician, really more of a musician than just a singer. I mean, because you have to be inside all of these chords and understand what's going on, how the melody relates to the chordal structure that's going by, how to play within it. And there's a level of emotion that has to come through too, I think.
How does a singer make it more likely that the instrumentalists are going to think of that singer as a musician?
Well, you have to be a musician. You have to know how to communicate with the instrumentalists. You have to know how to count off. You have to speak in the language of the musician. Not say, just not know how to talk about the structure of a tune and know what you want,
mm-hmm.
and being able to direct without being bossy, of course, but know how to, you have to know what you're doing, for goodness sake. I mean, when you're tackling something like improvising or even just singing a standard, you have to come in knowing the melody. You'd be surprised how many kids in high school and college level even come in to sing a song and they don't know the melody.
Well, how about the really just nitty-gritty things of knowing your keys and having...
Oh, yeah, there's a whole list of things that you really should know before you get up on a bandstand.
Give me a couple, if you don't mind.
Well, you should know how to count off a tune,
mm-hmm.
in the feel that you want, in this time signature that mm-hmm. you want, in the tempo that you want. One of the most horrible things I think you can ever do is if a tune starts and it's too slow, to turn around and start, you know, that's not cool at all. I think you have to know how to end a tune. I mean, there's different ways you can do it. You have to be ready for certain, there are certain turnarounds that mm-hmm. are very, you know, standard.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to direct that. And then again, I think you have to, I mean, if you're improvising, you have to know the tune. You have to know, feel the changes going by,
mm-hmm.
and be able to spontaneously compose something that is a story, not just quotes. But mm-hmm. you know, it's a difficult thing to do.
Do you think they're teaching it in the new school and all that?
I think that there are some schools and some teachers mainly mm-hmm. that are teaching it.
Okay.
Teaching everything. I mean, not just, you come out of, I mean, you know what Charlie Parker said, one of the famous things he said is, if you don't live it, it won't come out of your horn. Well, I think that that should be taught a lot more in schools, especially like Berkeley, where it's just as important to live and to tell a story when you're playing as it is to go through the chords, play the scales, you know. Anyone can play the scales, really.
Yeah. Right.
Jazz vocalist Giacomo Gates has one foot in 2025 and the other somewhere around 1955. He has the bop thing down and peppers his language with terms like straight ahead, solid baby, and you've got to learn to hang. He expands on Janis Sigel's comments on defining jazz singing and vocalists as musicians.
I could read, at least I could speak the musician's language. As a singer, I'm on the bandstand and I'm part of the band as opposed to in front of the band.
Boy, that really is a distinction, and I was going to ask you, as a musician who gets in, part of the way you work is to come into town and play with a group, and you may or may not have played with some of them or all of them.
Mm-hmm. Mostly not.
How do you get the sidemen on your side?
I think part of it is the repertoire. Because when I first started to do this, you know, even learning the music, I always dug the Great American Songbook, but I sing a jazz repertoire. There's a whole lot of jazz singers out there, and they're singing. You know, how many jazz singers does it take to sing My Funny Valentine? All of them. So, I mean, it's a great song, but I don't sing it. Chet Baker owns it, as far as I'm concerned. But I sing, you know, I sing Thelonious Monk. I sing Charlie Parker. I sing some Dexter Gordon songs. I sing standards. But when I first started to go into New York City, when I moved back to Connecticut and started to go into New York City, there used to be a lot of sessions, and now there aren't. But as a singer, you know, they used to have a sign-up sheet. And you'd write down your name and what you play. Well, there's not that, there weren't that, and I don't think there are that many male singers. So I ain't pretty, I know that. So I'm not going to get called up on the bandstand because I'm pretty. Come on up here, baby, and sing whatever, you know. So I would go up and sing Well You Needn't. I'd sing Yardbird Suite. I'd sing, you know, not a singer's repertoire. And they dug it.
So when you went up, so if you went up to the bandstand, that situation, and you wanted to do a standard, do you feel compelled to do it in the original key, or do you have your keys together? And
well, I'm lucky. A lot of the songs that I sing in the standard key, which certainly makes them happy.
Yeah.
I mean, you play. You know, a good musician can play in any key, but they're comfortable in the keys that the songs are in. I mean, if I could sing, you know, it does make a difference. I mean, if I sing something in A flat and in B flat, there's a big difference for me, especially if I'm singing the solo. There's a bigger range, so I need to be in my sweet spot. But you'll make a musician happy if you can call Well You Needn't in F as opposed to E flat.
Yeah.
Because he's not used to playing it in E flat. So I want them to be able to not think and just play and have a good time. So we can all have a good time. As opposed to being busy reading. Or, you know, can we do Lush Life in D? D? Why, is that too fast?
I'm going to remember that one. That was a good one. Why do some instrumentalists not think of singers as musicians? What causes that?
Well, I think that there are a lot of singers who are musicians, but there is a whole lot of singers who aren't. And what I mean by that is, I mean, I learned how to play the piano when I started to sing seriously. But I would never do a gig on the piano because I don't play that well. Mm-hmm. But I can sit down and play the changes. I can hear the notes that are in the changes. You know, I know what the bridge is as opposed to the middle. So I want to speak their language. And it makes them comfortable. It makes me comfortable. You know, it's more than the language. I believe there's a certain protocol up there on the bandstand. You know, there's a certain thing. There's a je ne sais quoi that's supposed to happen. And a lot of people don't know about that. And maybe because today it's a different world.
Do you feel that you have the license to ask a person to play differently?
It depends. If I hire musicians for a date, then I'm hiring them to play what they play. I'm hiring them to play them. If I'm working with a trio and I don't know the trio, or even if I do, if I want less from somebody, if I want more space, I don't have a problem in asking them for more space. And that's what I'll do. I'll ask them, could you give me more space?
And that's the word you would use.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not going to tell anybody how to play. I might ask for someone to play softer, but I'll never say, hey man, could you play more like, you know, Freddie Green?
Okay.
You know, I don't think that's right. Could you play more like, you know, Ben Reilly? Well, why don't you call Ben Reilly if you wanted that? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I had the good fortune to record with Ben Reilly.
No kidding. Wow.
And there were several Monk tunes on the record. The record company cat, Mark Edelman from Sharp Nine Records, he put together the band. It was David Hazeltine on piano, Peter Washington, Jim Rotundi on trumpet, and Ben Reilly. I show up and I see Ben Reilly, and I'm like, wow. So we're doing Epistrophe with my lyrics, Ask Me Now, Speedball, a couple of tunes like that. And Ben Reilly's looking at the list of songs, and he says to me, you a tenor player? I said, no, I'm a singer. Can I use French on this?
Of course.
He said to me, a singer? You gonna sing this shit? I said, yes, sir. He said, my man. So that, I mean, there you go. I mean, Ben Reilly, I got all the respect in the world for Ben Reilly. But he was happy that I was singing Speedball and Night in Tunisia, because I'm singing a real, what I like to think of as a real jazz repertoire.
I don't think Giacomo would mind if I shed a bit of light on the Lush Life joke. Billy Strayhorn wrote the song in D-flat, now designated as the standard key. Requesting that the band do it in D might generate some puzzled looks from the accompanist, resulting in Giacomo's response, "What, is that too fast?" His description of a typical jazz recording session is worth noting. He may show up for a recording session arranged by his producer. He may or may not know all the players, and they may have no idea what tunes are going down on wax that day. We can safely assume that Beyoncé, Michael Bublé, and Taylor Swift don't work like this. The necessity of creating and maintaining your own sound, your own voice, has been stated by a lengthy list of our interviewees. During our October 2001 interview, celebrated vocalist Diane Reeves defines her approach and describes the role of jazz in her life.
Well, I feel that I come from a place, a foundation, that allows for the celebration of uniqueness. That's how I view jazz music. And through that, I'm able to take the kinds of, songs, lyrics, or ideas, and give them that kind of freedom, free sensibility, free the ability to change from night to night. And that's what I love, because to me, that's what life is. And I think jazz is life. I equate jazz with life and life experience. And so I guess that's what I mean when I say that. I need to be able to take the music and give it, breathe life in it, just like I learned. Just what I listen to anytime I put on a great jazz musician or a great jazz vocalist, that there's life in the music. How do you make that? How do you draw a picture and make it have dimension, you know? And I think that's, you look at it, you see how, for me, I see how it addresses my life. And sometimes there are songs that don't necessarily address my life, but there are places that I need to get to. And I believe that there's power in words. And so that's why I select them to sing, because I'm trying to get to that place.
I sometimes wonder if the uniqueness that Diane Reeves mentioned becomes more difficult to achieve as the years go by and the list of innovative musicians grows longer and longer. Ben Sidran is a pianist, vocalist, songwriter, and masterful interviewer. It was rather a treat interviewing an interviewer. Ben addressed the unique sound topic. Here are his words. All the interviews I've done really affected my playing. The first thing that people tell you is to be yourself. If you're trying to sound like somebody else, you're doomed to be second best. They're already doing it. End quote. Joe Williams was a man who had his own sound. He was also co-founder of the Phileas Jazz Archive. I'm not sure who actually summed up these words of wisdom about achieving your own identity, but they sound memorable coming from Mr. Williams. Here are the three Asians.
Start by imitating. Don't be afraid to imitate someone. See, we all did. And you go from imitation to assimilation. And from assimilation to innovation. But you can't improvise if you don't know the melody.
I love it. Imitation, assimilation, innovation. Did you write that down? It's jazz vocabulary time. Let's focus on a few of the terms offered by the vocalists in this episode. First up, the bridge. Essentially the B part of the tried and true 32-bar song form, organized as AABA, eight measures each. Every member of the band should be able to know when the bridge is coming. Sometimes called the release, avoid calling it the middle. Next, Standards and the Great American Songbook. For jazz players, these terms mean almost the same thing. Songs mostly written in the 30s and 40s that were adopted by jazz musicians. If you're serious about the music, you should be able to perform them on the spot, in multiple keys, without referring to a real book, an iPad, or your smartphone. Janis Sigel mentioned being able to count off a song. It seems obvious, but there is a technique to it. First, get the tempo right, and importantly, add the proper vocal inflection, body language, hand claps, finger snaps, whatever it takes to set up the groove. This is not the purposely stilted elementary school band count off, as in 1, 2, 1, 2, ready, go. It's more like, okay, I'll take the A train. A one, a two, a one, two, three, four. Or in the case of a jazz funk tune, okay, I'll Cantaloupe Island. A one, a two, a one, two, three, ooh. It takes practice and a bit of scatting. Speaking of scatting, The ability to scat is often cited as a requirement for true jazz singers. Basically, it's improvisation, but with a voice rather than a sax or trumpet. The singer improvises melodic riffs with combinations of vowels and consonants. The voice becomes an improvising instrument. Lastly, a term I never heard on the bandstand, the soapbox. The Webster Dictionary definition, an improvised platform used by self-appointed informal orators. Which brings us to part two of this episode, where the host climbs up on a soapbox and orates a few tips for aspiring singers who hope to fit in with the band. Let me share three anecdotes that demonstrate how to get off on the wrong foot. Years ago, I was subbing on a solo piano gig, providing background music at a popular Central New York restaurant. I'll play both roles in this all-too-familiar exchange. "Oh, you play beautifully. Would you mind if I sang a song with you?" "Well, okay. What would you like to sing?" "Well, I'm not sure. What do you know?" "How about Wind Beneath My Wings? It's quite popular now." "Oh, yes, I love that song. Do you have the words?" A second story was related to me from the pianist who normally plays that gig. This time the singer does have a song in mind, actually knows the lyrics, but not the key. The pianist has to make his best guess. He plays an intro, the singer starts, then stops and says, "That's too high. Can you do it in minor?" Lastly, an informal summer jazz concert. I'm sharing the stage with six instrumentalists and a vocalist who is asked, "What would you like to sing?" The response, "How about Summertime?" "So far, so good." "And what's your key?" The singer responds with a dismissive laugh, "Oh God, I don't know." Now, if you're a singer listening to these anecdotes and your response is, "So where's the problem?" You have some work to do. After many years of playing in bands with lead singers and working as a vocal accompanist, I feel qualified to offer a few do's and don'ts to singers hoping to enter the gig scene. And I'm stepping onto the soapbox. Do have your own collection of lead sheets with chords, intros, endings, and an indication of style. A written out melody will result in the best possible accompaniment. How do you assemble this? You engage a qualified pianist or guitarist to prepare them. This is a vocalist's version of paying for lessons, like all instrumentalists do. Do learn the etiquette of sitting in when invited, followed by developing a stage presence that connects to the audience and is inclusive of the band members. Do know your lyrics. If you forget a line, don't stop. Learn to operate off the cuff. Check out the Ella Fitzgerald recording where she drew a blank while singing Mack the Knife. Ella kept swinging with improvised lyrics and brought the house down. Do buy your own quality microphone, cord, and stand. Suppose I was called to sub for a saxophonist on a particular gig. I show up and say, "Well, do you have a sax for me?" Too many vocalists think it's okay to ask, "Where's my mic?" Your instrument may be conveniently in your throat, but that does not relieve you of making an investment in gear like everyone else on stage. And go a step further. Learn how a PA works and offer to help load out at the end of a gig. The band will notice. And a few don'ts. Don't give your accompanist dirty looks if they make a mistake. It will not inspire them to play better. Don't be careless with other people's equipment. Avoid the current practice of holding a smartphone to read lyrics. It screams amateur. Don't commit the faux pas of stepping on someone's instrumental solo. Learn the song form and performance etiquette. The Oxford Dictionary defines diva as a self-important person who is temperamental and difficult to please, usually in the field of music. Don't even think about being one. And do go back in this podcast and re-listen to Janis Sigel's advice about the singer as musician. I'm stepping down from the soapbox. You can check out the full video interviews with these vocalists and many more on the Phileas Jazz YouTube channel. Our thanks to Doug Higgins and Michael Coe for assembling these podcast episodes, and to Romy Bertel for transcriptions and content advice. Episode 36 will focus on accompanists, and we'll hear from some of the best. Let's go out with some serious scatting. Contractually, I cannot divulge this artist's name, but I'm guessing most of you will get it. See you on the flip side.
Do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do